as part of this home group. I know that recently he's had a milestone in his recovery, and I feel privileged that he's part of our home group, and I've asked him along here to share his experience, strength and hope with us this evening. Thank you very much, Keith. Over to you, brother.
I'm Keith. I'm recovering from addiction. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Keith.
How about you?
My clean date is 4th of July, 2000. I have been through the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous multiple times with sponsors, and I have a working knowledge of the concepts and the traditions, and I have a service position. Those are my credentials. I was born in 1958, and my parents were just a year out of high school, and my dad was sick. My mother married him out of pity and to desire to get away from her mother, my grandmother. So that's not a great start. 3 years later, my father was dying, and he was filled with rage and resentment and pain pills, and he tried to kill me and my mother. He failed, and he killed himself instead. I think he was trying to be a family annihilator, but he just couldn't get the job done. And so that's how I began my life. 9 years later, when I was 12 years old, I tasted drugs for the first time. And it was a revelation. I felt a part of. I felt okay. I felt safe. The fear went away. It was the best feeling that I have ever had. And I spent the next 30 years getting loaded, trying to get that first feeling back again. Because it didn't matter what I used, I never could get that first feeling back. I spent 30 years trying. And in the course of those 30 years, everything in my life was fucked. Because chasing that feeling was the most important thing. And so, like many of our members, I went from job to job to job to job. I went from friend to friend to friend to friend. I went from apartment to apartment to apartment. I couldn't hold on to anything. And that's just the way it was. And then, on July 4th, 2000, a guy that I knew from the other fellowship, a juicer, came, took me for a ride. It was a holiday. And he told me that he thought that I had a problem with drugs and resentment, and that, you know, NA was the place for me, that his fellowship wasn't right for me. And I said, okay, well, you know, I didn't have any dope that day. Just a coincidence, I guess. So I stayed home, and I didn't go out. And I stayed home for another couple of days and detoxed. I didn't realize at the time I was detoxing, but that's what I was doing. And then on Thursday, so this is 3 days later, it was a Thursday night, I went to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And it's a young people's meeting. It's called Young at Heart, and it's still here. It's just not as close to my house as it used to be. And I only remember one thing about my first meeting. And at the end, they said to me, "Don't worry about it, man. Just go home tonight. Don't get loaded. Come back tomorrow. That's it. That's all you got to think about." And that seemed like a reasonable thing to do. So that's what I did. And the next night, I walked down to another meeting. Both of these meetings were in my neighborhood. And at that meeting, the group said to me, "Hey, Keith, this guy is going to be your sponsor." I didn't know what a sponsor was. I said, sure. He seemed a little scary to me, but I said, sure. So I had a sponsor. So I didn't have to do anything. Groups used to do that kind of thing. Groups used to, you know, make sure that newcomers at least had a temporary sponsor. They don't do that so much anymore. I think we've kind of lost that. It's a good thing. We should return to that if we can. Anyway, you know, I spent the next 13 years, you know, working my recovery, doing what you guys told me to do, doing the best I could. But I kept hitting a wall. And, you know, people with time started telling me, Keith, you know, you've got these mental health problems that we can't help you with. You need to go get help for that. And so at about 13 years clean, I finally started getting help for that. And I did that for the next 5 years, and it changed everything. It supercharged my recovery because there was this wall between me and successful recovery. And dealing with those mental health problems tore that wall down. My mental health problems were from trauma, not clinical, not organic, from trauma. And so they're easier to treat. And, you know, life went on. All the ups and downs of recovery that we all know about. Friends come and go. Partners come and go. But, you know, I kept staying clean just for today. And I did the things that I was told to do. My first service position, I was, you know, an ashtray washer. We used to have ashtrays. We don't have ashtrays anymore in meetings here. And ironically, there was big discussions going on about it at the time within the area about smoking meetings, because lots of people were saying, we're tired of going to smoking meetings. But the state of Colorado stepped in and banned smoking indoors, so, you know, by constitutional amendment, so that solved that problem. And, you know, I did service. I did a couple of terms as a group secretary, did a couple of terms as a group treasurer, did a term as an H&I panel coordinator, did two terms as an H&I literature chair, and, you know, my recovery moved along. Nothing extraordinary happened. I didn't become an extraordinary person. I was just a regular, you know, working class addict that was staying clean, doing the best that I could. And then at 15 years clean, I got sick for the first time. I got a bacterial infection in my lungs from a poorly serviced humidifier. And it was bad. I almost ended up hospitalized. And that's when I first started reading In Times of Illness booklet. Because I needed to understand what to do. Because it was clear that I was getting sicker and sicker, and that I may have to take some medication. And so I read that cover to cover a few times. And I talked to some other addicts who had been sick, get their experience, strength, and hope. And then it became clear, you know, I was getting sicker and sicker. You know, and I also had what's called tracheitis. And so I was coughing constantly. And so the meds they were giving me to try to heal my lungs weren't working because of the constant coughing. And my doctor said, Keith, either you take this medication I'm going to give you, the cough syrup that contained a medication, or I'm going to put you in the hospital against your will, and we'll do it there. You know, those are your two choices. And so I chose to take the cough syrup. And what I did was I set up, based upon all the reading that I had done and talking to other sick addicts, I set up a medication journal, which I still have sitting right next to me here today, and what I call a circle of accountability. Back then, it was six people. I invited six people to be part of my circle of accountability, and five accepted. And what I would do is, you know, in my little thing of cough syrup, whenever I would take a spoon, I would write it down, and I would call another addict. And that was my way of making sure that I was being accountable to other addicts and to myself and to my higher power for what I was doing. It was necessary. The first little jar of cough syrup, we're only talking a half a dozen spoonfuls, didn't work. And so my doctor insisted I take something stronger, with a much stronger medication in it. And I did, and it worked. And eventually I got better. But what I learned was extraordinary. I learned how to maintain my recovery while dealing with illness and medication. And it comes down to what I call radical accountability. I make myself accountable to myself, to my higher power, to my sponsor, and to other addicts. And that's how I kept my recovery. And I remember thinking about it at the time. One of the things I did is after I got better, my doctor said, you're better now, but things have changed. Your lungs are damaged from this. And from now on, you need to be extra careful in cold and flu season. Because if you get a cold, then this condition you have now, I was left with a condition called interstitial lung disease, will flare up. So you have to be careful. And so I prayed about it a lot and talked to my sponsor, and I realized I had to make some changes in how I worked my recovery. And they were very difficult changes. I had to stop doing Ketax. Because newcomers are like kindergartners. They're full of viruses. and I knew that, and I had to stop. I couldn't do it anymore, and I haven't done one since. And I started going to phone meetings. We have a phone fellowship here that some of you are aware of in the United States, NA by phone called. And so I started doing these phone meetings, and it was great. They got me through this whole period of illness. It was wonderful. And then I realized that I needed to continue to go to the phone meetings, that I was now an addict that had multiple fellowships. I had my local fellowship, but I also had this virtual fellowship. Remember, this is 2015. And so I did. And I sat down with sponsees, and I said, look, you need to understand that what regular meeting attendance looks like for me has changed. You will see me at physical in-person meetings through the spring and the summer and fall. But once cold and flu season hits, I'm gone. And you will not see me all winter at an in-person meeting. And that's what I did, because that's what I had to do to keep myself safe. I didn't like it, but it was the right thing to do. And I suffered emotional consequences from it, but it was still the right thing to do. So. And then, as many of you know, some of you know, 3 years later, I got cancer. And the only fortunate thing that happened was I knew what to do in terms of maintaining my recovery. I immediately got a circle of accountability of 12 addicts, because I was going to go through cancer treatment. This was going to take a while. And I couldn't put the burden just on a few. I had to spread that burden across a group of people. So there were 12 people that were part of my circle of accountability. And so for the next, 7 months during my cancer treatment, I did the same thing. 4 times a day, I had to take a med. 4 times a day, I wrote it down in my medication journal. 4 times a day, I prayed and asked my higher power to let the medication do only what it's supposed to do and nothing else. 4 times a day, I called another addict. And I felt really awful. There were lots of times I wanted to skip that whole call on the other addict part, but I didn't. Because I wanted to maintain my recovery. And that's how you do it. And I got through the treatment. And then at the end of that 7 month period, I had a palliative care doctor specialized in medication. And I feel really grateful for that. And he weaned me off the meds. And I went through a detox period of a week or 10 days. And I ate a lot of chocolate and mung beans. Mung beans are a wonderful detox. You cook them like lentils. And I got through it. You know, since then, you know, my circle of accountability is down to 3 people. Since I don't have to use meds on a regular basis anymore, they're intermittent, but I still have those 3. I still have the medication journal. It's the same journal. It records everything that I've done since 2015. And I keep doing it because we can maintain our recovery through times of illness, but we have to be scrupulous, committed, and never waver from that commitment of transparency and accountability. Never waver from it. Because fundamentally, philosophically, I don't underestimate the disease of addiction. It's as much a threat to me today as it's ever been. And as I was going through my cancer treatment, the disease of addiction was a profound threat to me because the disease said to me, hey, Keith, you're going through cancer treatment. Who's going to know? Just take an extra one. Nobody's going to know. You know? And taking things not just as prescribed, precisely as prescribed, is a fundamental tenet to maintaining recovery through times of illness, precisely as prescribed. And, you know, and I learned some other things during this process that I hadn't learned in the previous illness because it didn't last long enough for me to learn anything new. I learned that that I had to stay committed on a daily basis. I couldn't give the disease an inch, not an inch. I just couldn't do that. One of the other things I learned was that illness and recovery doesn't end for me. It's my life now. You know, I continue to suffer the consequences of cancer. I hope I'm still in remission. I won't find that out. I see my oncologist tomorrow, as a matter of fact, but I have a procedure that I have to get in a couple of weeks, so he won't know for sure if I'm completely in remission still. I hope so. But cancer is like the disease of addiction. There's no cure for cancer. You know, it could come back at any time. You know, we don't have a cure. Or it could come back somewhere else. You know, I still live with the consequences of cancer and the consequences of the treatment. You know, my insides are messed up because of the radiation. My brain is messed up because of the chemotherapy. As some of you know, I have kidney disease, and it was caused by one of the chemotherapy drugs they gave me. That kind of sucks. But that's just what happened. It saved my life. So I don't know if it's a good trade or not. I think so. Some days I'm not so sure. And you know, life's hard now. There's nothing easy anymore. You know, I look back on my life. My life was really easy for a long time, except for the difficulties and harm I caused myself. My whole life I was healthy. I was reasonably bright. And if I hadn't had the disease of addiction, who knows what might have happened. But I did have the disease of addiction. It runs in my family. You know, I have an uncle with the disease of addiction who just passed away. I have numerous cousins with the disease of addiction. You know, it runs in families. You know, it's not always the case that it's genetically passed on or it's culturally passed on. But in my case, it is. And so here I am today, doing the best I can, coping with life the best I can, and I still do what you guys taught me to do 22 years ago. I go to meetings every day. I have a sponsor. I have an assignment, and I've been dilly-dallying, and I need to call my sponsor and get an appointment to go over it. You know, I have a higher power that I talk to and pray to every day. I have friends in the program. I have many acquaintances in the program. And I keep doing what you guys taught me to do. I didn't think, I haven't thought up anything new. Everything I do was taught to me, was given to me freely. Because that's what we do in this fellowship. We don't hoard our knowledge. We don't hoard our experience, strength, and hope. We share it freely with the still-suffering addict. And whether that still-suffering addict is a newcomer or an old-timer doesn't matter. The still-suffering addict is a still-suffering addict. And when we give that addict all that we have to give, our experience, strength, and hope. And it's up to them to do something with it. And for reasons that I'm still not completely sure of, I decided to stay with you guys. I made that decision that our traditions talk about. So when it says membership is not automatic, you know, each addict, each member has to make that decision to be a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I made that decision a long time ago to be a member of this fellowship, to be part of this community. And I have yet to regret that decision. So I'm very grateful to be here today, and I'm grateful to be part of the global HIGNA Fellowship. I am so grateful that HIGNA exists, and that I've gotten to know some of you, and that I get to come to these meetings. And I guess that's all I've got, and I'll keep coming back. Thanks for letting me share.